Hello, and thank you for joining us today for our podcast covering the digital fundraising trends of 2021. I'm Rabia, I'm the customer service manager here at Charity Digital, and I might be a familiar face and voice to some of you. The subject of digital fundraising is so important right now and is crucial for charities looking ahead. As we've seen, 2020 was exceptionally challenging, but it proved that the charity sector is versatile and resilient in the face of just about anything and is ready and adapt to meet the demands of the new normal. The year 2020 demonstrated the importance of digital, which was particularly essential in terms of fundraising, as we all tried to find new ways to connect with supporters, find new ones, and so on. Zoom and video conferencing helped maintain donor engagement, virtual events replaced the physical ones, campaigns became quirky and innovative, online donations took priority over the traditional tin bucket, and so on. As we see now, 2020 looks to be another challenging year. Today's podcast will look at some of the digital trends and developments that will ensure charities can stay up to date or even ahead of the curve. I am in our physical office today at the Charity Digital headquarters. We do have some very keen builders outside, so I apologise if any of that noise filters through. If we have any sort of outages or anything, our team is ready and waiting in the wings to jump in the face of any kind of sudden issue or anything. Today, I'm joined by Emily Casson, the Digital Marketing Manager at Cats Protection, Samantha Doe, the Digital Engagement Lead at Action for Children, and Matt Collins, the Managing Director of Platypus Digital. I'd like to thank you all for joining us and sharing your expertise with us in today's podcast. The first thing that I'd like to ask you is something that I'm sure a lot of our listeners are interested in, and I am as well. So to kick off, what are the main digital fundraising trends on the horizon for 2021?
So I think one of the main trends is going to be a continuation of what we saw in 2020, that a lot of people donated online for the first time in 2020. And we've kind of seen that continuing, that a lot of like website donations were 100% up from previous years. So I think one of the big trends that's going to move is moving away from your kind of traditional methods of donation to more digital methods, that in particular kind of web and text giving kind of really took off in 2020. And I think that's something that we're definitely going to see continuing.
Yeah, I completely agree, Emily. Action for Children actually added Google Pay and Apple Pay to our wallets on the website this year. And that made a huge difference in conversion rate, among lots of other things. But that kind of seamless connection with donating, making that process as smooth as possible for people, I think is going to be a real focus for fundraisers this year.
Yeah, we've seen similar successes for a lot of our clients. We had one client who said that they'd raised 250% more in February 2021 just through paid search than they did in February 2020. Like, this is a massive increase. And digital fundraising, it's not a new trend by any stretch of the imagination. You know, a lot of the platforms we're talking about making such a big difference, search and Google Pay and things like that, have been around for a really long time. But it's really now that they're kind of coming into their own. A lot of the face-to-face events obviously have been cancelled or postponed. And so if you want to give to charity, then that is the main way to do it. I'm always really hesitant to talk about trends, because I don't think trends are what matters in digital fundraising. If you're a digital fundraiser, then you're a fundraiser first and a digital person second. So if you're not raising money, then you're not doing your job. And you should be raising money through the most effective platforms and the most effective tools and techniques. So anything that's new that comes along is by definition very untested, and therefore arguably a lot less likely to bring the returns you're looking for. So we're always really keen to do, you know, the things that Samantha and Emily just talked about. So those are the things that work, those are the things that raise money and ultimately change the lives of the charities that they're raising money for.
That's really interesting, Matt. You said people are a fundraiser first and digital second. I'm probably the opposite way around. I lead the digital engagement team, so I'll be thinking more about kind of the supporters and our users, and thinking about how we can adapt and kind of promote digital in a way that will work for them. And I think, it was a trend we saw in 2020 that will continue, is around kind of value exchange. And I think people are looking to do something to help, but they kind of expect something in return as well. So our innovation team are looking at new products and new things that we can spin up that offer that value exchange for supporters.
I think that kind of we've been working on for like the last few years, but really took off last year. Like last year, particularly our kind of lead generation, we did a homeschooling product called Moggy Modules, where people could get access to home education content. And we found that kind of with all our lead generation campaigns, we recruited 126,000 leads last year, up from 30,000 the year before. So we've really seen a lot of growth because, like I said, people want a hand raised, they want to get involved, particularly in the current climate and the current mood of the last few months, that they want to get involved but don't necessarily kind of have the direct cash, or they want to see kind of what value they're getting back from the charity. And I think that's definitely going to continue, as well as what you're saying around the innovation piece. We've invested heavily in that the last few months. And I think a lot of charities are, because we saw kind of a year ago the quizzes really taking off and every charity under the sun kind of doing their quizzes. Whereas I think we're now moving past that to look at, okay, how can you find something that's really going to appeal to your audience? That at the minute we're piloting a craft along where people can join and craft your own little felt cat, kind of in the model of your own cat. And we found that's really successful so far in pilot stage, because people want something that connects them to the cause rather than necessarily yet another Zoom quiz. So I think it's how can charities kind of tap into that and find their niche in the very crowded digital space.
It's so interesting that you mentioned crafting, because I was having a conversation with some of my colleagues on a craft Zoom a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about craftivism and that movement whilst people are continuing to, you know, be at home and looking for creative outlets in what otherwise kind of quite an insular space. That connection to being part of something bigger. And I think crafting and that kind of that value exchange that crafting can unlock, if you can find a way to monetize that, can help connect up more groups of people, I think.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with kind of what Matt's saying about I'm a fundraiser first, and it's about kind of using digital to build up those communities or tap into existing communities, that digital is kind of just a vehicle that you can do that. And particularly with crafting, there's a lot of existing communities that people are really keen on this. So it's how the charities can kind of work with them and tap into that space. And I think gaming communities is another one we've been looking at, that Twitch and things have really taken off this year. And not just even people playing games. We've managed to raise tens of thousands of pounds from people just talking about their cats and their communities donating. So it's kind of really tapping into that sort of very niche audience, but the people that are really passionate about the cause and talking to them on a platform they want to talk on. And I think I agree with Matt, like the platform's not the most important starting point. The most important starting point is looking at the people and the fundraising and the impact we want to make for the charities, and then seeing which are the most appropriate kind of channels and tools and techniques to do that.
It sort of depends on what stage people are at in the kind of marketing funnel, as it were. So you might have people that are aware of your charity, know its name and know the great work that it does. And really all you need to do is present the most well-crafted, well-timed ask on the right channel. Say, please donate as a cash giver, please become a regular giver, you know, selling a virtual product or becoming a fundraiser, whatever the most appropriate ask is. But there's a much wider and often a group of people that gets more focused right at the top of the funnel there, who aren't really aware of your charity but might be aware of the cause that you work in, or might, you know, they have a cat and they might care about the cat, and I have kids and they care about the kids, and you know they're at home and they're looking for things to do. And if you can engage some of the stuff that you know about, that's going to introduce them to the brand, you know. And there's the classic adage that you need to expose people to your brand 7 times before they consider purchasing. I mean, I think there's a lot to that, and that's why lead generation is so effective, because you're giving people something useful, something that adds some value to their lives. And then from that, they may become more interested in your work. And certainly the digital lead gen value exchange campaigns we've run in the past have led to loads of regular givers. You know, they have that outcome. So if you have something useful, this information, activities, you know, products like a pin badge or tote bags are the classics, then, you know, look for a group of people that might be interested in getting them, and then sort of craft your ask for further down the funnel.
craft your ask. I like it.
No pun intended.
I completely agree. And I think that's one of the spaces that I think virtual events has really opened up this year. We launched a new virtual event in 2020 called Boycott Your Bed. And that was reaching those top of funnel people who might not have necessarily heard of Action for Children before, but want to do something different at home with their families. So we were asking people to sleep in an unusual place for the night and take part in a live event with comedy and quizzes and all sorts of different things coming on, so they could feel like part of that bigger collective group of people coming together to make a difference as well.
Yeah, I think as well it's a great one of our exchange to partner with like other teams across the organisation. Like we do a lot of work with the APSU team and kind of doing petition-based lead gen. And like the Moggy Modules one I mentioned was the education team had these amazing resources. So it's how can we partner to get them out to more people? Obviously, I'm coming at it from a fundraising angle, but from their point of view, we have thousands of people working with their kids, teaching them more about cats, which is absolutely what we're about in terms of the aim. So I think it is a great one to engage the wide organization in fundraising and kind of get them really excited because they can see the kind of really direct result of that, whether that's a Facebook Live with like one of the teams around kind of Q&A or whether that's something kind of more in depth than that.
Yeah, you're going to see more of a trend towards that stuff, I think, for the rest of 2021, arguably. None of us here, I think, are brave enough to predict the future of COVID and what the next round of restrictions will look like and what the next round after that and after that might look like. But I think what you can say is that online events and online challenges have really opened up a lot in terms of inclusivity, because even the biggest events, that's the biggest live challenge events that charities have run, so you think of like Race for the Kids that Great Ormond Street Hospital do, you know, really it's a couple of thousand people that can attend those in person. Virtual events, no matter where you are in the country, you can be in the most rural areas, but now you can suddenly attend events, you can take part in fundraising, and even if all the restrictions close tomorrow and we're back to normal, quote unquote, then you know you'd be crazy to miss out on the opportunities and the lessons that the last year of fundraising virtually and trying to do virtual quizzes and virtual challenge events have brought us. And make sure you stay in touch with the new fundraisers that this has brought to your charity.
Absolutely. I think it will help us be less city centric, and as you say, pull in people from all across the UK, which is only a good thing. The other thing I think is really interesting isn't necessarily a fundraising trend, but taps into something you just said there that I think will be a lesson we'll have learned from the last year, is around shorter term planning. So applying more digital approaches to, you know, being agile and iterative, and instead of working out your fundraising agenda and your fundraising plan for the whole year and kind of sticking to it, reviewing that on the regular and working out what we need to adapt and change to suit whatever the latest set of circumstances are, which I think will be a really quite different way, I think, from a traditional charity's way of working, but of real benefit.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, if ever there was a year that showed you that plans are not worth having, but planning is essential, then this is it. And reforecasting has made the biggest comeback in fundraising that you could ever imagine. You know, it's something you just got to do regularly.
Yeah, and I think it's like so important to be flexible. And we've always kind of done that a bit in the digital team, but I think it's spreading across fundraising that having that flexible approach and actually being able to take advantage of opportunities that come along.
Exactly.
A lot of great things during COVID where, say, we've got these great opportunities on a digital space, particularly around kind of Facebook advertising and TV advertising that's been extremely cheap over the COVID period. And yes, there's definitely a lot of downsides, but I think digital is great at bringing people together. And you can really utilise that for your charity, as well as having a lot of people very bored at home on the screens all day that are desperate for some great content.
Definitely. I also think there's a moment in time here we're at now where charities will be taking stock, working out what they managed to churn through in 2020. And I don't know about you, but the digital team were absolutely busier than ever because anything that was physical became virtual. And I think now it'll be a case of actually taking a step back and working out what was most effective, what is the best use of our time, and also thinking about ways we can upskill and support the rest of the organization to think and do more digital themselves as well. Because we're only a finite resource and we can only spread ourselves so thinly. So making sure that we really hone our energy where we can add most value is going to be very key.
That's such an important process, you know, and there's such a great opportunity to do it, because, you know, even large digital teams and large charities just have more and more to do. So to be able to take a step back and go, look, what are we trying to achieve here? You know, are we trying to get community fundraisers on board? Is regular givers our prime targets? You know, are we looking for service users? We just want brand engagement. Really trying to focus what you're trying to do, and then having to think about what the best channel to do it on actually is, because that is a really big problem with digital stuff generally, is there's new platforms coming out and new trends coming out, and there's so many shiny kind of objects for us as like magpies to just kind of chase after and go after, and they may well not be, they could be the worst thing, I mean they might be the best thing, but they're probably the worst thing for what you're trying to achieve, and they can just be massive distractions. You know, if your charity is sitting there going and spending most of its time going, you know, how do we create a clubhouse strategy? You know, that's not going to get you where you need to go. So to have that reflective process, like you clearly had Action for Children, is really effective. And that's going to serve you for years to come, no matter what the restrictions are.
Yeah, and I think a lot of charities last year were doing digital fundraising often for the first time. I know a lot of charities that have recruited their first digital fundraisers, that it's kind of an area was on their horizon but wasn't necessarily a priority, that suddenly become top priority to kind of upskill the staff and organisation on digital fundraising. But a lot of them see, like saying, all the shiny new toys and think, whoa, this is so much, how do we prioritise? And I think that's going to be key, like you say, for all charities, big and small this year, whether you're at the start of your digital journey or much more mature in that process, what do you actually prioritise? What is going to make the biggest impact, rather than focusing constantly on the next big thing or just getting overwhelmed? There's so much you could do in digital that you end up doing nothing, that it's much better to do kind of baby steps. And our model we use is kind of think big, start small, scale quickly. So yes, we could do all the things, but what can we actually pilot that we can then scale up?
Yeah, we talk a lot at Action for Children about MVP. What's our MVP for this? Or what's our minimum marketable product for this? To get something out the door and then iterate and grow and scale it up from there if it's working.
Is this a pause where we jump in with a really clever point? Because like, I'm going to struggle to top that one.
Isn't it funny that we have, as you know, digital marketers, digital fundraisers for years been saying, you know, this is the future, this is the way it should go. You know, we spend so much money on face-to-face and telemarketing, and but you know, you can get really good returns on digital. And it only took a pandemic for people to go, oh great, let's do digital.
Yeah, I mean, necessity is the mother of all invention, for sure. And it's great that there's that kind of external, you know, drive and impetus, rather than just kind of people internally, you know, tapping, you know, senior management on the shoulder, excuse me, this might be a good thing to do, you know. I mean, that is effective to a point, but not quite as effective as all of this stuff. I mean, overkill maybe, but yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's similar with kind of remote working, that I've been talking about that for many years, but it's only since the pandemic that everybody's been forced into that. And I think in 2021, it's going to be quite interesting to see what people go back to or don't go back to. That I know some people are going fully remote, some people are kind of doing hybrid models. So looking at what are the best digital tools you can use to collaborate internally if everybody's working remotely, as well as that understanding that the public and your supporters, their lives have fundamentally changed, and how can you kind of still bring them into your community?
I'd love to hear the conversations that happen at charities that previously didn't allow home working and didn't allow any kind of remote working. You know, imagine tomorrow we could all go back to the office full time if we wanted to. And some people say, well, actually, I'd quite like to be at home, say 2-3 days a week, and then in the office 1 or 2 days. You know, what's the response to that going to be? Like, oh, no, you can't. Well, the last year has shown that I can.
Absolutely.
And I can still get really good results for this organization and drive the charitable objectives that we exist to promote, you know, and so what would be the argument against that? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I don't think they have one anymore. The evidence is there. As you say, we've worked in this situation for coming up to a year now. And people have really stepped up and proven that they can make it work. And there's a level of trust required both ways. And that line of communication, digitally or otherwise, is really important. So, I hate to admit it, but Microsoft Teams has come into its own for us as an organization this year. We use that for our video calls and meetings, but also for kind of project management and setting up a specific campaign, working groups and places to store your documents in SharePoint and collaborate on documents together. So it's been a bit of a baptism of fire for some teams, I would say, but one that's really, really worked.
Yeah, I think because from my team, we were all remote pre-pandemic. So we were already set up. So we kind of had a head start on a lot of other people because that was our current model. But I spoke at a conference last February, a lot of directors of fundraising who were actually on remote working, and they were absolutely adamant, no, it never worked for us, we'd never be able to do that model. And by a month later, they were all getting in touch saying, oh, can you come do a workshop? We are now ready to do that. So it's kind of amazing how quickly mindsets shifted. And I think that if it had just been a couple of weeks, we probably would have gone back to whatever people were doing before. But I think a year later, and people have seen, particularly Microsoft Teams, that it has just made life so much easier having video calls. I mean, I used to live, as Matt well knows, on a train up and down to London. And it's made life so much easier for a lot of charities and collaboration. And I'm a big fan of Mural, that a lot of various different projects. But yeah.
Yeah, Mural's great. I think there's still a lot of people craving a physical post-it note. And I think there'll be a huge sale and an increase in sale on post-it notes when we're allowed to start meeting up in person again. But Mural's been a fantastic tool for us pre-pandemic. But yeah, it's absolutely come into its own. And more teams outside of digital now are using that to brainstorm and plan their work.
I've got a box of physical post-it notes that's never more than a few feet away from me. Just the tactile nature of them. I just kind of hold them and just remember what it's like to be in a room and peeling them all off and then putting them in individual piles to make notes on. You know, it's just anything you can do to keep yourself sane. But in the meantime, we've got Mural, we've got Jamboard is really good. So there are ways of running brainstorming activities. And really essential to do as well, just to get you out of that headspace that you're normally in, because you can't get out of your physical space anymore. The way you used to get out of your mental space was by taking yourself on a train to a different office or a different city or whatever. Now you can't do that. So you just got to get your brain into different places and getting into more of a top level long-term horizon scanning place using tools like Jamboard and Mural and all the rest is a really good way of doing that.
Definitely. I do think the piece around being so insular and the normal outlets you would have to switch off and change scene just still aren't there and won't be for a good while. So I do think that's potentially an ongoing challenge that fundraisers and digital teams will face on an ongoing basis, because the digital world never sleeps, does it? We're always so connected, which is fantastic, but also we're always so connected, and it's important to set up some well-being barriers and some ways to be able to manage that, to be able to detox and switch off, and that's something that I'm really conscious of, particularly with my social media team, and making sure that if they're always on that news agenda, particularly with the news agenda quite often being so pessimistic or quite draining and exhausting, it's how do we balance that and give them the space and time to prepare themselves to be resilient, to come back stronger.
Yeah, I think particularly 2021 is going to see a big shift towards well-being, because I think we started seeing it last year, and how do we look after digital fundraisers that have had a very different experience of the pandemic to a lot of other fundraisers. Very few of them have been furloughed, and like I said before, they're busier than ever. So I think it's more important both for those frontline ones working with kind of members of the public, monitoring Twitter feeds, but also the ones behind the scenes doing more and more work and having more and more pressure on them. So I know there's a lot of initiatives around wellbeing at the minute, and I think that's going to be so key. And also seeing how we can use digital for wellbeing for our supporters as well. There's often a crossover, like I was saying about crafting and things, that's also a great wellbeing activity as well as a fundraising activity.
Absolutely. And I think digital services will still continue to be on the increase as people, you know, look for alternative ways to get that support that they need. So really clear, concise, digestible information is going to be at the heart of that. And I think one of the challenges that a fundraiser will then face is potentially exploring how we monetize some of those digital services.
Have you guys seen a big increase in demand for digital services? Because I think a lot of people, if you're listening to this podcast, you might be trying to make the case to Board of Trustees or senior management team to invest more in digital services or in digital fundraising, but services specifically. Have you seen big increases in the demand for what you offer as a charity?
Yeah, we certainly have a Action for Children. We launched on a national scale for the first time our parenting coaching online service called Parent Talk. So that was launched last July, and it was as a result of seeing such a huge increase in demand for parents just at the wit's end, you know, trying to work out what's what, looking for someone to turn to just talk to. And it wasn't just simply about information, advice and guidance for them. It was also about just having that emotional reassurance that they're okay and that they're doing as good a job as they possibly can. So Parent Talk is still in huge demand. That demand hasn't you know dwindled at all, you know, almost a year on from the activation of the pandemic. But it's definitely something that we will look to continue to get funding for and continue to provide way past you know coronavirus.
Yeah, and I think kind of very different charity, but Cats Protection, we've kind of seen, we've been doing a lot of hands-free homing. So that was obviously forced on by the pandemic, but we found that actually doing all the paperwork via email and e-signatures and stuff and providing the services and instead of doing tours of people's houses, can kind of do it with video tours and things to do house checks, that we found that's kind of been really popular with the public and actually kind of rates have gone down and people kind of giving back their cats afterwards, which is really positive because we were worried that with only a digital interaction, if somebody's adopting a cat, how would that work if they've never actually seen it? Whereas because we've been able to do a lot of videos and things, actually we found it more successful and being able to do more follow-up calls. And I know for like our education kind of talks and stuff that we normally do like in schools and community groups, we're already kind of booked up. I think it's June they're booking now, that because it's just been really, really popular because people want, well, partly something to do, but also want to learn more and have activities to do. So I think that's definitely something kind of pre-pandemic will continue offering, the kind of virtual offering as well as the physical, which does also have the benefit of cutting down on travel time and things like that. Oh.
Matching up the channel options with kind of service users or supporters' needs, we found with Parent Talk that the one-to-one online chat nature of what we offer on the service is potentially more appealing to fathers, to men. So you know we're meeting a need there that perhaps they might not get so readily through face-to-face services as well. So again, going back to your point earlier, Matt, about inclusion and access, it gives us the ability to reach more people from wherever they are. They haven't got to physically get themselves to a children's centre or speak to someone, which might feel intimidating in a kind of face-to-face or telephone environment. They can do it from their home, wherever they're comfortable, on their mobile.
Okay, so it seems like we've covered so much amazing information here so far. I'm really interested in hearing a little bit more about how you've been able to use digital to connect with sort of well-being for your supporters. You've talked a lot about, you know, sort of, it's gone out of my head, the making with the crochet?
Crafting.
I'm so sorry. How you've been able to use crafting to connect with your supporters and how supporters are connecting so directly with your cause and how you've been able to discover new information about your supporters through digital means that you might not otherwise have discovered in sort of person. And how do you sort of predict that this might continue for other charities? Do you think that your digital interactions with your supporters will now be a key part of how you interact with them in person?
Yeah, I think definitely. And I think something that's been really interesting is actually supporters interacting with each other. So like we did a baking challenge in the summer, which was because we normally have a pause and tea kind of afternoon tea event where people host their own, which obviously we couldn't do at the time. So then set up a Facebook group and did different baking challenges every week, like different cat related baking things. And people really, really loved that. And they really loved interacting with each other in that forum. And I know a lot of other charities are increasingly setting up Facebook groups for running challenges and a lot of that peer-to-peer support and kind of really sort of what we're talking about before, building up that community angle of like we're building up a community of people that love cats, and the vehicle for expressing how much they love cats can often be through donating or volunteering with the charity. But it's very much putting the cause first and interacting with these people.
Yeah, I completely agree, Emily. The collective nature of allowing communities, allowing our supporters to talk to one another is really key and taps into that mindset of feeling like you're part of something bigger. And yeah, I think that's going to continue, particularly with things like Facebook algorithms prioritizing groups and events now over pages. I think those sorts of things are going to become very, very important and integral to digital strategies and fundraising strategies moving forward.
In some ways, it's kind of a classic fundraising stewardship sort of challenge in a way. You know, you've got these fantastic online communities on, say, Facebook groups where the people who are doing a fundraising challenge together can share their experiences, share top fundraising tips and kind of motivate each other through their stories and through their successes and challenges and all the rest of it. And then the kind of next step for those, you know, when restrictions allow, might be a face-to-face fundraising event where you're hopefully looking to increase the average amount raised per participant. You know, whatever it is the next stage in the journey for those people for your charity. But, you know, you've got these great online communities and, you know, they existed for real life challenge events before this and definitely during. And let's just make sure they continue afterwards as well, because they're those connections, those emotional connections are why charities do what they do, and they're so fantastic and can change so many lives. So let's just hope they continue. And if you're not doing them, then you know, I think it's pretty straightforward. You know, you set up a Facebook group and invite the people that are doing a challenge to join it, and you'd be amazed what people will do kind of after that in terms of sharing experiences. Be prepared to do a bit yourself to get things started, but the strength of the crowd is really fantastic.
And the very nature of digital channels is that it's a dialogue. It's not a broadcast channel. So you'd be silly not to, you know, make the most of the fact that your supporters are willing to have a conversation with you and with their peers. So you can mine that. There's so much opportunity to understand and ask questions and get insight of the people that you're trying to reach, you know, your engaged supporters and also prospective donors as well, and apply that into lots of different areas of fundraising.
Yeah, and I think as well, kind of building that some of your supporters can be your biggest advocates, that they're talking to their friends, they're talking to their family, like if they're really passionate about your cause, they'll naturally be saying, oh, I'm doing this event, do you want to come and join? And pulling new people that might have never heard about your charity, pulling them in and kind of raising awareness. And then it's how do you as a charity kind of steward these people? And I think that's a really exciting space that digital allows you to reach these really big audiences. And often a lot of it is just what would be happening organically anyway, people chatting to each other in person, but now online, it's much more visible and much more potential to scale it.
Yeah, and I think the qualitative nature of that data is going to become more and more important with things like, you know, cookie management being very key and being compliant on people, you know, not automatically being opted in to cookies, marketing cookies. So whilst we might lose a little bit of that quantitative data through things like Google Analytics, we'll be having to think about ways we can innovate and get that information through other streams.
Yeah, because I think there are a lot of compliance changes coming. We're doing a lot of minute on the iOS 14 update from Apple, and that's something I'd urge all charities to kind of look into how that's going to impact their tracking on that. And like you say, how can we use different means and stuff to interact with people? And having the difficult conversations internally about the digital ethics and kind of which direction does your charity go down? Because a lot of it kind of, it's legal, but it's legal if you tell people you're doing it and are really upfront. And I think that's something we're going to see a lot more of this year, that it really come to the fore in terms of, do people actually know what they're signing up for? And when we're talking about cookie management and making sure that it's really clear to your supporters what's happening to their data, and they've had a chance to opt in or out of that.
Yeah, I think supporters are so much more discerning now than ever before. So it's a legal and a moral obligation to provide them with the information they need. And if you are really upfront and clear about that, then hopefully you will build that trust. And as you say, Emily, you know, build that brand ambassador, build those people that will regularly support you and come back to you and champion you.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of kind of other kind of challenges coming up this year, particularly obviously with Brexit and a lot of the data rules, because what we found, particularly in the last year, that data is kind of an insight more important than ever on everything. And there are a lot of things like that might impact on it. And kind of where data is stored and the sort of kind of impact that we might have. And not all of that's necessarily clear now. So I think for a lot of charities, it's a case of, okay, what can we prepare now? Or what do we think is going to be coming? And what actions can we take now to kind of prepare ourselves for things that might happen? And particularly involving leadership group and stuff, so they're aware of what might happen and what their role might be in deciding that.
Yeah, taking them on that journey, but also bringing in, you know, a working group of your compliance team, your technology team, fundraising, to understand what potential options there could be. And as you say, Emily, be as prepared as possible. So there are cookie management platforms out there that your digital teams will be exploring for their websites. You can look at getting one installed before making any decisions around what you want your cookie policy to be, just being prepared with what the platforms are out there that allow you to adapt and change is going to be very, very important. But as you say, bringing your senior leadership team on that journey as well to make them understand what the risks and mitigations are as well.
So funny, isn't it? Like, trying to predict the future with all of this is trying to create certainty in a world that just doesn't offer us that certainty. Like, it's, well, this change is coming and that change is coming and we think it's going to go that direction. You know, a lot of the time that certainty just doesn't exist. And even where it does exist, you know, you might be listening to this thinking, well, we're a small charity. We don't have any compliance teams. We don't have any digital teams. You know, this is me with an interest in digital, listening to a podcast about it to try to learn a little bit more. You know, where do I start with all of this? I'm not going to get to any kind of data compliance stuff because that's just the nature of the time pressures on my role. So if you're thinking about where to start on all of this, I mean, I'm interested to hear what Emily and Samantha think. But for me, it's about making sure you've got great content on your website that people will find useful. You know, we're talking about big fancy service delivery products and so on, but really, you know, posts and articles about what people can do to help whatever it is your charity does, and emailing your supporters more, you know, just asking them to do things, asking them to become fundraisers, asking them to sign up to regular gifts, asking them what they think about things, you know, just using that really underused but, you know, almost free platform if your time pressures are such that you just don't have time to get to anything else.
Yeah, I think email is a key one, partly because you obviously have to have a really clear opt-in for that and people on your list. And it is definitely, like say, an underutilized platform that we've found our list has kind of grown by a third in the last year. And that's one of the strategies that us and a lot of other charities are looking at, to be like, okay, there's a lot of changes we know are coming on other platforms. Once people sign up to their email list, we can then look at how we can send them great, really engaging content. And we found that kind of open rates and kind of click-through rates have doubled in the last year because more people than ever are kind of having the time to open emails and click through, and often driving more conversions than you are through some of the more kind of passive marketing that people might see in their feed rather than a kind of direct personal email. So I think a lot of it's going to be thinking about, if you haven't already got an email list, how do you set one up? And then even starting with the very basics, whether that's a newsletter, welcome journey, whatever it is, it's certainly better to have something rather than nothing. So I think, like, to Matt's point, I say, haven't got anything in place, like, don't be scared, start small and definitely do something. And then really think about, well, what is really going to engage this audience? And from their point of view, what are they wanting to hear about from the charity? And that will mitigate some of the compliance changes and stuff coming if you're going directly into their inbox with really great content.
Yeah, and as you've both said there, you can ask your email list what they want to hear about, what they're particularly interested in. But even with, you know, basic email platforms, you can drill into the data and see what links are most clicked on and what topics are of particular interest, you know, articles you post on your blog, which ones get the biggest clicks driven through from your email, so that you can tailor your content to suit those audiences and potentially start to identify some particular segments. So there might be a group of supporters that are interested in a particular part of your work. They might want to help with your influencing and your campaigning. There might be another audience that's more interested in doing something through crafting or some sort of physical challenge. So there's different ways you can then drill into that data and make it work for you.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree. I'm a complete data geek. I love all the that you can get from that and really steward people to the content they want to see based on their interaction with you. And I think that's a really exciting area to explore about how we could take that even further and do really kind of personalized bespoke sport journeys for people.
Yeah, my absolute favorite report that I've ever come across, if we're getting seriously geeky, is the search terms reports in your Google Ad Grants account, your paid Google Ads account. And what that shows you is the exact search terms that people searched for when they clicked on an ad that landed on your website. And it really is, I mean, depending on what you do as an organization, it can just be the most eye-opening exercise into the very specific situations, i.e. very specific search terms that people Google, that people find themselves in. And it can really show you know, what the need is out there, how diverse that can be, and it almost really sort of paints a picture into the lives that people have and what they're facing. So if you have an active Google Ad Grants account or Google Ads account, that's a really powerful one, I think, to check out.
That's a great shout, Matt. The other, on a more micro level, the other search function we refer to quite a lot in my team is the internal website search, and seeing what people are searching for there. And it might give you some indications of content that's a little bit harder to find, or give you, as you say, a bit more of an insight into how someone is determining that content for them, what relates to them when they search for it. And have you got that reflected in your titles and the descriptions of the content and things like that to help them find it more easily?
Yeah, I think nothing kind of beats that sort of user research. And I mean, some charities now have big focus groups and everything, but even at a small scale, like asking a few people not familiar with your charity to find some things on the website and feedback, how easy it was, how difficult, how long it took them, and being able to make those small little changes could have a really, really big impact. But it's so often something that gets lost when we're all so busy, actually going out to supporters and be like, oh, can you try this or pilot this, or going out with people, like I say, that know nothing about the charity space and just ask them something as simple as how easy was it to donate? And then you can do really simple tweaks on your website off the back of that. Because if one person's having a problem, that's probably multiplied multiple times.
Absolutely.
Yeah, usertesting.com is really good for this. You can just pay a couple of $100 and you can select the demographics and even the countries and genders of the people you're most trying to reach, and say, here's a specific job I want you to complete on our websites. Try and do it, share your screen recording and talk us through your thought process. And when I've done that and played the recordings to clients, you know, their eyes are really opened into things I would never have thought would be problems in a million years. And equally things I didn't think would be really motivating and inspiring in a million years. But, you know, if you really want to get out of your own headspace and not think about you as the, you know, digital engagement lead or whatever, and actually the audience you're trying to build these things for, there's a few more powerful tools to show you that perspective than someone going, oh, well, this is really off-putting. You're like, oh, is it really? And then, you know, that's the stuff you really want to know.
Yeah, because often what looks amazing to a digital person doesn't work for the end user. Often it's stripping out all the bells and whistles and nice bits and just having the really kind of basic ones, or actually the layout that the digital team might think looks amazing. It's so important to test that and say, well, does that actually work for the person using this form, rather than, oh, we think this is really cool.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Are you doing this for the person that needs it, or because you want to get some sector press coverage?
Yeah.
This is incredible. I've really refrained from, you know, jumping in and trying to direct the conversation too much, because listening to this sort of organic exchange of ideas is brilliant. I'd love hearing about how you've taken sort of such a creative approach, like a really fresh approach to tools and data that you already have. And I think that would be great for our listeners, because, you know, sometimes even as a layperson, you know, you hear the term digital fundraising and I start thinking I need to, you know, TikTok and this and that. And to hear how you've been able to harness something like Google Analytics and email, sort of, you know, getting people to look at things, it really speaks to the power of kind of a creative, open-minded sort of approach. And just sort of throughout the conversation, really, it's just been so eye-opening to hear about things that, you know, you've been able to do at your charities, but sort of, and you know, with such different causes, you've been able to drive such powerful results and things, and how you've been able to discover sort of more information about your connectors, particularly during this time that, you know, had you not created these large sort of digital campaigns, you may not have discovered that fathers respond more so to these things, that there's, you know, there's a group there that needs more support and things. So that's just been so interesting to hear. And I just really want to thank you for your expertise and, you know, just really driving home the message that being agile is key, sort of, you know, connect with your cause. And one of the things that I found the most interesting hearing all three of you talk is how when you sort of think about digital, it can seem such a sort of, you know, it's on a screen, it's kind of can seem a little bit impersonal, but how you've been able to use this seemingly impersonal tool to drive such, you know, holistic, real, organic kind of change and, you know, connect with supporters. So as I sort of sit here gushing, I mostly just want to thank you all for your time and your expertise, because it's been so insightful for me to hear. And I'm sure all of our listeners as well are going to love hearing all of your ideas and advice and anything. As we kind of go towards wrapping up a little bit, is there anything particular any of you would like to mention or emphasize or repeat?
Me, I think the thing I believe most is do what works. You know, don't always get distracted by TikTok, Snapchat, Clubhouse. I mean, not to say that they're terrible and can't be used, but, you know, really focus on what works. You've got limited time. You have, you know, most people aren't just doing this all the time. Just find some things that work and focus heavily on them, and focus on charitable objectives first and foremost.
Yeah, I think I'd kind of echo that. Start with what are the aims of the charity and how can digital help you reach that, rather than the start point of, ooh, this really exciting digital channels, what can we do in that space? And I think I would add to that and say as well, just getting the basics right. And for small charities, doing something in the digital space is better than nothing. And even if it's just picking one channel and focusing on that and then building that up, that's far better than kind of not doing anything.
Yeah, and just to add on to that a little bit, it's not just about knowing your business objectives, but knowing who you're trying to reach and what their objectives are as well. So if you know those two ingredients, and there are lots of different ways we've discussed, you can get a bit of that data and insight, you can then, yeah, work out the right digital channel mix to support those goals.
Amazing. Okay, I would like to thank you all again, Matt, Emily and Samantha. Thank you for your time and your comments and this great conversation. I'd also like to thank all of our listeners for joining us today. And please get in touch with us here at Charity Digital if you have any questions or comments about anything you've heard today, anything you'd like to follow up on. And yes, it's been a great conversation. I think that's a great place to wrap up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. No, thank you all. Thank you.